The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. The topic today is skill or skillfulness. It's a very important topic in all of Buddhism. And the word, both in Pali and Sanskrit, is upaya. There's a wonderful Zen center in New Mexico that's called Upaya, based on this idea of skill or skillfulness. Sometimes the more full word is or phrase is Upaya Kusala, and Kusala means Upaya means or method, and Kusala means skill. So Upaya Kusala Upaya means skill and means. Skill in methods, skill in approaches, skill in activities. So one of the reasons why this is important is that I like to think of Buddhism as a series of instructions of how to become your own teacher, rather than a series of instructions of what you should do, like strictures that you have to do this, or teachings that you have to adopt in some dogmatic way. The whole set of teachings are set up as a way to support you, help you understand how to become your own teacher. And in that regard, it's always been my dream that I could talk my way out of a job. But so far, it doesn't seem to work too well. But listen carefully. And the idea of skillfulness, I relate to the topic of helpfulness, in the sense of what is helpful and what is not helpful. And so to learn, to have a sense of what is helpful for yourself, for others, for the world around us, what is skillful, and then to be able to enact or do those things which are skillful or helpful. And that requires some ability to monitor or read a situation, and then to have some sense of what is useful in a situation that will have beneficial consequences. And so the idea of behavior or ethical action or activity in Buddhism is often seemed to be understood or measured situationally. Every situation has its own appropriate response to the situation. And we don't go into a situation with a preconceived idea that this is what should happen, this is what is, but rather we take our time to read the situation, to discover what's there, and then given the situation, then there's a response that is skillful, or we try to avoid the responses that are unskillful. The emphasis on skillfulness can be seen in a very famous in Theravadan world little set of verses, a four-line verse from the Dhammapada, which is sometimes considered to be one of the kind of pithy summaries of the Buddha's teachings. I'll give you first more or less the literal translation and then offer you a slight variation. Avoid doing evil. Cultivate what is skillful. Purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddhas. So the first line, avoid doing evil. Some people don't think it's very skillful to use the word evil. So the word is connected to the Buddhist kind of personification, God of death. So there's a very good scholar of our tradition who prefers to translate not as evil, because it's not quite right, given that, you know, the connotations, and, you know, it's not a good match. But he prefers the word deadening. Avoid doing what's deadening, what takes life away from yourself, drains you or drains others, or kind of deadening. And then do what is skillful. Purify the mind. This is the teachings of the Buddhas. So this idea of the second one is cultivate what's skillful. In some places in translation, they'll translate this as, because it's a contrast to evil, they'll translate it as do what's good. Avoid evil and do good. Purify the mind. But the idea of good is so vague. And it lends itself to a kind of little bit, maybe kind of black and white idea of how things should be. Whereas the idea of skillfulness is much more nuanced. It's much more situational. It's kind of like, what is skillful? It begs the question, how do you discover what's skillful? Another reason why skillfulness is useful is that skillfulness is portable. That you learn a skill, you can take that skill with you in different situations. If you, like in meditation, if you attain a particular state of meditation, it's probably not that portable. You might be lucky to carry it with you for a few minutes after the sitting or for a little while, but it's the skill, the understanding, the ability to monitor yourself and adjust and meet the situation, that is what's useful over time. So one of the ways to approach meditation practice is not that you're trying to attain a state of calm or concentration for its own sake, but rather the calm and the concentration that we can have in meditation is sets us up to be able to monitor and see and have insight into the situation, not to see necessarily the true nature of reality, but to understand how we can respond better, how we can read the situation better, read ourselves better, and understand what is skillful and what is not skillful to do. So part of the training in Buddhism is to develop a skill set, to develop the skills we have so we can use those skills in different circumstances. So one of the skills is the skills of mindfulness, the skill of being able to stop and pay more careful attention to the situation, understand what's going on some more with greater clarity than it would be if we were just barreling along, business as usual, not paying much attention. But to have an ability to have sharpened attention to the situation and what's going on. And that's a skill that can be cultivated and developed. It's connected to the skill of letting go. It's a wonderful skill to let go because for a variety of reasons. One is that it helps us to see more clearly. If we're just barreling ahead with our own desires and wishes and mindsets and understanding, we can just completely miss what's going on around us. So the ability to at least temporarily let go or suspend our desires, our wishes, our views is a very important capacity in order to be able to see more clearly. And as we see more clearly, you might invite back some of your views and understanding if they're skillful or helpful. But it really helps to have the ability to let go, let go, let go. Also, letting go is very helpful, that skill. It's like a muscle, learning how to let go. Because as you begin to strengthen that muscle, you might be able to learn to let go in increasingly important areas where it's useful to let go. So, for example, it's one thing to let go, on the freeway. I mean, there's a long line of cars ahead of you, and you're impatient. And you say, well, you know, it's nothing I can do, so I'll let go and kind of not be so tense around driving my cars, given the circumstance. Maybe that's a relatively easy situation, maybe. But we practice in these small situations. And then it might come a time where maybe you are really angry with your boss. And maybe you have good, even if you have good reason to be angry with your boss, it might not be skillful to act on that anger because of all the people who are going to suffer if you're unemployed. So how do you do that wisely? How do you engage in that anger wisely? Well, perhaps because you've been practicing letting go and developing a skill for it, you know enough about letting go of the grip of anger so that you're not likely to act on it in unskillful ways. And perhaps you can find skillful ways to respond to the situation because you've learned how to let go of the grip that you're being caught in the vice of the emotion of the moment. So it's a skill we learn to develop, and then it's a skill which we're meant to be used skillfully. To understand, skillful means to understand, have the wisdom to see when it's useful to let go and when it's useful to pick up something. When it's useful to cultivate something, to do something, when it's useful not to do something and let something be. So for example, if you come into a new situation that is maybe challenging, maybe what's skillful is to not speak and not act right away, but take your time. Find out what's going on. Ask other people what's happening and how are you feeling and all that. Whereas, and then later, once you've taken in the information, maybe then you can kind of assess what's needed from you. And so then you kind of engage in that. So the idea of skillfulness. The English word skill comes from an Indo-European root word meaning to differentiate or to separate. And in fact, in Norwegian, which I speak, the word still means to separate. It's the word is pronounced skille. So the H and the K kind of get interchanged in English and Norwegian. And to separate out. And the ability to be skillful is to be able to make finer and finer distinctions and understanding about what's happening. And so we say that someone who's skillful, like a skillful swimmer, repeats the movement of swimming over and over and over again. It's a lot of repetition, training yourself to be a swimmer, same stroke for years. But as you do it more and more and more, the swimmer can learn to make finer and finer distinctions between the subtle movements that go on. Whereas when you first start swimming, you're just flailing around. So the repetition of things over and over and over again allows us to take in the information of what's going on and see the subtlety of what's going on. We can make more and more useful distinctions and have developed skillfulness. So this applies to meditation practice. One of the reasons to do meditation practice over and over and over again, one of the reasons to over and over again for decades meditation to follow your breath is that you make finer and finer distinctions of what's going on inside. You'll start seeing the subtlety of how the mind operates and how what goes on in the body. And as you see more subtly and more nuanced what's going on, you see a greater range of choice you have in how you continue the meditation and what you do. And so this involves a lot of monitoring. And so an important part of mindfulness and Buddhist practice, the beginning of learning to be your own teacher, is to learn to monitor yourself, which is another way of saying to be mindful of yourself, mindful of the situation. But it takes a lot of time. Don't be in a hurry. And this is, you put yourself in the same laboratory over and over again in order to slowly begin to kind of tease apart and discover what's really happening, what's going on. So something like meditation practice, retreat practice, is part of this domain where we do things over and over again to start seeing not only more subtlety, but deeper and deeper the movements of the mind, the attachments of the mind, the different belief systems that are operating, the different kind of identities that are operating what we're doing, the the ways in which we respond to challenges are a great thing to discover in meditation. Sooner or later in meditation, you'll be challenged. And maybe that's when meditation begins. Some people think it's over when you're challenged, but actually, in terms of kind of the Buddhist path of maturation, perhaps that path of maturation begins when you're lucky enough to get challenged in meditation. It's not working so well. And so then you can turn around and look and see what's really going on here. Look more carefully. Are there expectations involved? Is there straining or striving going on? Is there resistance or contraction or tension happening as part of the doing? What's going on? What's your relationship to the challenge? Do you see it, you interpret it in a way that's not so useful? Are there different ways of interpreting? Are there ways of not interpreting and just being very simple with it? I would be very sorry, or not sorry is maybe not the right word, but worried about someone who received the instructions in meditation practice, sat down, boom, went into deep concentration and bliss and just kind of, just kind of floated along for years that way. In fact, I know people who do something like that, not necessarily the first time they sit down, but I've met people who have developed a meditation practice that allowed themselves to go into bliss. And then they just hang out there for years. They go into bliss, go into bliss, go into bliss. And then they come and do an insight practice, come and retreat. And we tell them, instead of sitting there in bliss, why don't you notice what's going on? And they'll come back to the next interview, and their eyes will pop wide open. And they'll say, I had no idea so much was going on. And then after years of doing the practice, they begin finally understanding what's going under the surface or behind the curtain of that bliss. They're much more complicated. In fact, what I've seen, I wouldn't want to generalize too much, so please be careful with what I'm about to say, but what I've seen more often than not is that people who have the ability to go into bliss states, great experience of emptiness states, for long periods of time, and that's primarily what characterizes their meditation, usually are avoiding something. Usually, sometimes they develop it as a coping mechanism. They have a lot of suffering in their life. And so it's a way of kind of coping, sometimes very wisely, with the suffering, because nothing else kind of works. But at some point or other, to stay there with that coping mechanism is not skillful. Maybe it was skillful at one time, but at some point no longer skillful. And so then what's skillful may perhaps is to begin opening up to what's behind the curtain of the bliss or the joy or the emptiness that's there, and discover a variety of things that could be there. The idea of skillfulness or being your own teacher implies that when you hear any instructions in Buddhism, you ask the question, when is this skillful? Or how is this skillful? Or when is this appropriate? How is it appropriate? In the toolbox of Buddhism, of the teachings of the Buddha, there's a lot of different kinds of practices a person can do. And so the question is, which of the tools is useful in a given situation? If there is a lot of anger, for example, sometimes being mindful might not be the right tool. Perhaps loving kindness is the right tool to do. Or if there's a lot of distress going on, maybe meditation is not the right tool in states of distress. Sometimes on retreat, when people come, and there might be a lot of distress going on, we will ask people or encourage people to stop meditating, not because they're now failing the retreat at any kinds of means, but because retreat practice, Buddhist practice, what it's about is not meditation. It's about meeting what's going on for the individual with the appropriate response. And so sometimes if someone's distressed, meditation is not appropriate. And we'll have them sometimes go work in the kitchen and doing something physical, being around community and other people, like the other cooks, is sometimes a very useful way of grounding people, helping them stabilize with their distress in a way that maybe can't happen through meditation. Meditation is skillful, sometimes meditation is not skillful. Sometimes other things are skillful. And, kind of a dramatic statement that I'm about to make. I don't know if I should say it. No one will ever come back here. I think that for people living busy lay lives they have strain and stress, for some people, what's most needed is basically to kind of calm down a bit. De-stress. And sometimes something like yoga or doing something physical is a faster way of de-stressing than doing meditation. Isn't that something? So come back, give us a second chance.
Once we're calm.
Yeah, come back when you're calm. So the question is, what is skillful, given maybe the stress level a person has, maybe it's not useful to hang on to the idea that Buddhism has the answer and it's the only answer, and so I have to meditate all the time. Maybe given my life, the next step in order to kind of be live a more skillful life, a more helpful life, a more useful situation, I need to relax a little bit. And to relax, I need to figure out something else besides meditation. It doesn't seem to help me that much. Maybe if I go on retreat, or maybe if I do it for a long time. So let's do something else. Let's do yoga or something, or go for a walk or do something. Some people, I say this because some Buddhists, put too much emphasis on the authority of Buddhism, as if Buddhism has the answer for everything. It has answers. It has a very powerful and profound series of practices, of methods, of skillful means that we can use. But the idea is not to be locked into them, but to ask the question, what is skillful? What is useful given the circumstances of my life? The idea of skillfulness and usefulness or helpfulness also is connected to the idea of purpose or goal. We measure what's skillful by the purpose we have in mind. There's no like just skillfulness in the abstract. I'm going to do what's skillful as if there's such a thing. So if a purpose, if you realize that you're hyper-stressed out and the primary purpose you're trying to do is to kind of de-stress, then you can ask the question, for the purpose of de-stressing, what is skillful? Or say that your purpose is to do the Buddhist path all the way, and then your question is, well, what is skillful for that? Well, in order to answer that question, I think I have to look at the particular of this situation now that I'm in. Both the micro circumstance of the day, maybe, of the month, of the phase of my life, and then figure out what's useful in order to be on that path. So it might be that it's useful to go do yoga before coming to meditate, or go running, or get more sleep, you know, in order before you, you know, try to do the Buddhist practice. It might be more useful to study a little bit, to try to understand the teachings better, if you know, to kind of understand what's going on. It might be useful to develop a community of friends who are also practitioners, so you have some support of a community. You're not doing it alone, because sometimes doing it alone can be quite challenging. It could be that the circumstances of your life don't allow you to do a lot of meditation in the classic way. You know, if you have four kids at home and you're a single parent and you have to work, it might not be reasonable to expect that you're going to meditate 2 hours a day. And so you want to be on the Buddhist path, but given the circumstances of the life, what is walking the path look like now? What is skillful? What might be skillful in that situation is to be ethical, to focus on the ethical precepts of Buddhism, and to start being impeccable or kind of heighten the level of impeccability around the precepts of Manda. And, you know, it doesn't mean you have to stop doing all the things you have to do and get through your life, but it means you do them with greater ethical care. And that would be the skillful way. And a lot of inner growth and development can happen that way. Someone else who may be different circumstance of their lives would, maybe what's skillful or useful is they can go on retreat. They can do a lot of practice at that phase of their life. And I wouldn't want to measure one as opposed to the other, as one is better than the other. I think that's not skillful. Because if you start measuring one against the other, one is better than the other, one's a real Buddhist practice and one's not, you know. What's the consequence of that kind of thing? If you really pay attention, as you ask the question, what is skillful here? Means what are the consequences here? Well, if those people are doing it right, the real practice, and I'm doing the lousy one, the second grade practice, or I'm doing the right practice and these other people are not really doing it, and why are they kind of like whatever? You know, if you really are paying attention, monitoring what that's like, you see it sets up separation, it sets up tension, it sets up all kinds of not so helpful things. It's not skillful. What is skillful, I think, so I ask, what is skillful? What's skillful is to appreciate each other, value each other. What's skillful is to appreciate that the appropriate response is situational. Everyone has different circumstances in their life, and given the circumstances of their life, they have to adjust and figure out what to do. In the 1970s, when I was a new practitioner, you know, the age of Buddhist practitioners in the 1970s in America was considerably younger than what the average is nowadays. So there used to be, you know, so like, you know, a lot of them were in their 20s and 30s. And so there was a much more physical limberness. And also a certain kind of zeal about being good Buddhists and stuff like that. So the idea of sitting cross-legged in meditation was a very high ideal. And there was very little appreciation among these hyper-idealized practitioners back then that there was other ways of meditating. And so there were people who felt like they had to meditate cross-legged on the floor. And I know people actually damage their knees by forcing themselves with this. And it's not skillful to damage your knees. Need knee surgery after meditating. I hope you understand that it's not skillful. And so some of the ones I knew who damaged their knees were not monitoring themselves. They had this idea they're supposed to kind of just be present and tough it out. And so they weren't paying attention carefully to the signals to the situation well. And so they weren't adjusting themselves according to what the need was. They weren't picking up the danger signals. What we've learned over the decades is that for certain types of bodies, certain people, it is skillful to meditate in a chair. And for other people, it's skillful to meditate on the floor cross-legged. One isn't better than the other. The idea is to practice with the circumstances of your life. And if your circumstances are sit in a chair, that's skillful. If you have the ability to sit cross-legged, perhaps that's skillful. Some people can't even meditate sitting upright. So what's skillful is to maybe meditate lying down, or meditate standing, or meditate doing walking meditation. So it's very permissive or very allowing, this focus on Buddhist practice, when the focus is what is skillful, what is useful. And when we appreciate that the answer of what's skillful is situational. It has to do with you yourself. It has to do with other people, what's the circumstances you're in. there's a lot of things to take into account. Finally, I'll say that this kind of emphasis I'm making today of monitoring yourself, figuring out what is skillful, not skillful, looking at all the tools that Buddhism has, can also tie oneself in knots. It becomes a whole engineering project. And so, but part of the monitoring is to monitor how you're searching for what's skillful. Is the way you're evaluating the situation, is it stressful? Is it agitating? Is it making you less calm? Or is it helping you be more peaceful? So this idea of skillfulness includes being skillful about how we evaluate skillfulness. And in that way, it's self-correcting. So if you find yourself always sitting down to meditate and always, spending the whole time, is this skillful? Should I be doing this? Should I be that? What's going on now? How should I do it? I'll try to remember that instruction. No, I'll try a different instruction. And then if you step back and say, what's happening now? Let's look at this. Is it skillful that I'm jumping around and doing all this? And you might decide, no, it's not. Maybe what's skillful is, since it's not obvious what to do, why don't I just follow the simplest instructions that I've heard about meditation? Sit down, close my eyes, and follow my breath. Since I don't know what to do otherwise. And it's not useful to jump around. And then as you sit down, close your eyes, and follow your breath, with time you might discover that something else is useful, some other focus. Maybe it's not just a matter of following the breath, but it's also a matter then of learning to let go of distractions. Or maybe it's learning that maybe you're tense when you're breathing. You notice that, and so you find that, I'm holding my chest always when I'm breathing. Maybe I can relax my chest, and that would be skillful and help me get into it more. So the mindfulness, self-monitoring that we do in meditation practice is a self-correcting, because we also look at the approach, how we're doing it in the moment. So hopefully this protects you from the possibility that the teachings on being skillful and being your own teacher doesn't tie yourself in a knot, doesn't get you caught up in evaluating, engineering the situation too much. It's very skillful to rely on simplicity. Not everything is simple, but if you always consider, what's the simple approach? How to be simple in a situation? If that's part of the exploration, you probably are not going to go wrong. So kusala, upaya kusala, skillfulness, skill in means. It's a very important concept in Buddhism. So anyway, we'll see. Between telling you that yoga is better than sometimes better than yoga sometimes better than meditation, and you should be your own teacher. I guess no one will ever come back, right?
We have yoga here.
Oh, we have yoga here. No, it was not planned. So any questions or comments about this? We have a few minutes. Can we move the mic? Is the mic over here?
There it is. I often find that I'm into literature, and couple decades into poetry, and sometimes I get a concentration when I'm reading really good poetry because it's some essential truth. It really resonates. It's not just thought, but it's like my whole body goes in. It's like an aesthetic response, but to some real resonant. A profound truth, and it's easier for me to get that response reading the poetry than it is in meditation 99 times out of 100, and I wish I could bring that to meditation. I just wonder if you had anything to say about aesthetic response, you know, to great art or something. Has anybody ever read poetry to enlightenment?
I think it's great that you know this about yourself and you have this access to this possibility of using poetry or literature to get concentrated and present in a nice way. Knowing that that's a skill or capacity you have, then it's something you can maybe use as, and make it part of your life that benefits your life, benefits the life of others even. And so, you know, it deepens you, it connects you, it maybe puts you in a good state. It might be interesting to meditate after reading poetry, if that's the case for you, and see what happens then with your meditation practice. Or it might be useful to read poetry before you have to talk with your boss about, you know, the challenge you have with the boss, right? And puts you in a different kind of focus. And so it's a useful thing to skill to have. Perhaps one of the things you can do is to notice some of the qualities, some of the aspects that are involved in your absorption in poetry. And, you know, both while you're doing it and after it's occurred, kind of, and then see if you can bring some of those qualities into your meditation practice. Because the absorption that happens in meditation practice is probably very similar to the absorption that can happen in, that you're having in poetry. So maybe there's something you can learn about that. Maybe both the state you experience and the way your mind functions to get into that state in poetry maybe can teach you lessons about what's needed when you meditate. It can, you can then kind of, maybe as you meditate, you sit down to meditate, you can kind of maybe intuit how to be with your breath in such a way that the breath becomes an aesthetic experience. And in fact, when concentration gets strong, I would say that sometimes focusing on the breath becomes not only extremely pleasant, but quite beautiful. Some teachers talk about focusing on the beautiful breath and the beauty of that. And it feels more and more beautiful the more concentrated you get. And that's part of the reason it gets absorbing. Here in the back for...
You mentioned situational ethics as part of your talk, but from what I've been exposed to in Buddhism, for example, can you hear me? The five precepts, it seems there's very little situational there. They are more absolutist, and various teachers have come by here and lectured on similar things, and they've been very absolutist in their views about certain aspects of Buddhism.
It's probably to some degree true. So two things, a number of things to say about that. is it's useful for all of us to look and understand what our relationship is to Buddhism, to Buddhist teachings. How do we understand it? What background do we have that influences how we see Buddhism or Buddhist teachers? When people come out of another religion or any religion, including Buddhism, there are certain understandings of what it means to be religious. And then if you go to a different religion, sometimes that's carried with you, and people assume that's going to be the same. I've known people who, for example, well, I don't want to mention religions, but I've known people who've come from certain religions, and when they come to Buddhism, they assume that to be a Buddhist, you have to discover what the tenets of Buddhism are, and you have to believe the whole package. And then some of those people find a great struggle because, you know, it's either you're in it or you're not. You either, you know, it's like so black and white. And so people can struggle for years with that. So you know, and Buddhist teachers say all kinds of things. And so what's your relationship to a Buddhist teacher? You know, do you see a Buddhist teacher as having, as an absolute authority? You see it as a guide, as a mentor? I'll see you, okay. See it as a guide or a mentor? And you know, if you spend your lifetime living in the Vatican, and you think that that's your reference point for what a Buddhist teacher is, you might listen in one way. But if you think that what a Buddhist teacher is a friend who's further along on the path than you are, you might relate in a different way. And so how much authority to give a Buddhist teacher is variable depending on all kinds of reasons what people bring. So you find Buddhist teachers say a lot of different things about ethics and precepts. Some teachers, like myself, will say the fundamental principle behind the precepts is, which is maybe a little bit black and white or absolute, is don't cause harm. It's unskillful to cause harm. If the idea is to be free, or if the purpose is to free the world from suffering, it's unskillful to cause harm. And we don't want to cause harm. And then how does that then translate in different behaviors? So generally, we cause harm if we kill people. And that's kind of a little bit black and white. there might be some people who will argue that the greater good is accomplished by killing some people rather than having a lot of other people die. So that's a whole ethical question, the moral question that people fit on different sides of that kind of issue. But generally in the Theravada tradition, it falls on the side as a tradition, as a religious tradition, no killing. But your relationship to that is up to you. There's no pope in Buddhism, there's no final authority that says, this is the truth. There's nobody like that, so you have to find your own way with that. But this tradition that we teach in tends to be a little more, and there's no exceptions to this, not killing. Don't steal. Now, are there times when it's skillful to steal? Some of the earliest law books from Europe in the 1200s specifically say that it's okay to steal if you're poor and your family's starving to death, that it's okay to steal a loaf of bread, that you'll be forgiven if that's the situation. So that's interesting that people, that even back then, were making that kind of distinction. Is that the case always, or so what's skillful? You know, in those circumstances, I mean, I don't know. Sexuality, you find Buddhist teachers who have particular ideas about what's right and wrong sexuality. I think that other Buddhist teachers who prefer to say, we don't have particular behaviors which are right or wrong, but rather we want to avoid inappropriate sexuality, and that's measured by whether it causes harm. Is anybody harmed by this kind of behavior or not? So is that going on and on? So now I'm curious what you wanted to say here. Can you move past the mic?
This might be too big a question or too vague a question. I'm not sure. Can you hear me? It's green. Can you hear me now? Oh, Okay, I wasn't levitating enough. This might be too big or vague a question, but I haven't done much sitting, but I've done a little sitting in the Zen tradition, and in listening to your talk, I sensed a difference in orientation between what you're saying to a certain degree and what I've experienced in my small sampling. I'm by far not a serious practitioner. So I think I was kind of wanting to have like, and I know you are in both traditions, and so I was curious from your viewpoint, what are the two, like what, if you could summarize, what are the differences, or what is one of the main differences
between Zen and...
Yeah, and insight. Yeah. And I realize it's a big question and not entirely related to what you were talking about directly, so if it's not appropriate,
well,
yeah. Then...
Well, it's really big, so I'll try to offer you something simple. I mean, depending on the days people ask me, I'll say they're very similar or very different. generally, I think it's kind of useful in California to make a distinction like this, is that Zen, as it's practiced in some of the practice centers here in California, is... a whole religious tradition. And so Zen is much more than meditation practice. It's a whole training in community and all kinds of activities a person does. Whereas the way that this practice, insight practice, was brought to the United States, it was primarily brought as a meditation practice. And so you're comparing apples and oranges if you compare Zen training with insight meditation. And we don't have a full-fledged training in the way, you know, we kind of brought the meditation, we're kind of reinventing the wheel here because we started off with this theory of meditation. But but if what you're comparing is Zazen, Zen meditation, and insight meditation, if that's the comparison, then in some one of my favorite ways of distinguishing the two is that the mature form of both of them are the same. But how you get there is different. In Zen, you're kind of thrown into the deep end and expected to swim. Whereas in Vipassana, you start in the shallow end, and you're slowly kind of taught to how to get to the deep end. So it's a little bit different. So sometimes for swimming geniuses, it works well to be thrown in. My friend Ed Brown, who's a great Zen teacher here in California, did both practices. And the way he distinguished it too was he said, Zen is like going, he's a cook, great cook. He said, Zen's like going into the kitchen and to make a cake without the recipe. Whereas Vipassana, you go into the kitchen with the recipe. And so, again, culinary geniuses can do it without, maybe even make a better cake if you don't have a recipe. Because if you're, you know, if you're a genius and, you know, but you're more reliably going to make the cake if you have the recipe. So I don't know if this is a good answer to your question, but it's what you get today. Thank you. So thank you all very much. And please stay for tea and... And perhaps it'd be nice, especially if you're sitting near someone who, those of you who've been here for a while, you see someone near you who seems like they're new or something, if they look like they're receptive to it, it'd be nice to turn to someone and say hello and welcome them here. Because my hope is that everyone who comes here will feel welcomed when they come. So thank you.